This is Beyond the Pass, conversations with people from all walks of hospitality life. Centering mental health, Beyond the Pass is a conversation about life, hospitality, and what makes us get out of bed each day. Beyond the Pass is brought to you by Kelly's Cause, and the conversational digressions are brought to you by me, your host, Rachel Kerlapsley. If you can take a minute to like, rate, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, that would be very much appreciated. Without listeners like yourselves, we couldn't keep having these brilliant conversations. Enjoy the episode and keep taking care of each other. Welcome back to Beyond the Pass. We are so excited to be sitting down with Michelle Moreno. Michelle is a true hospitality pro who has traveled all over the world, opening, consulting, and creating bars and restaurants. These days, she is the founder and director of QAB Leadership, and especially focused on supporting women into leadership positions across the industry. Welcome, Michelle.
Hello. I need that little speech.
I'll send it to you. I just want to start by asking how you started in the industry.
I fell into the industry. I thought it was going to be a lame page on the West End, which does sort of explains a lot of my slight extrovertedness. And I fell wonderfully, like a sliding doors, into the opening of St. Martin's Lane Hotel in London, which was the first time Schrager came to London. It was a very, very lifestyle brand that London had. We had luxury and high end, but we hadn't really started what lifestyle high end looked like at that stage. And I am from a background of, like, you know, we have egg and chips, and I didn't know red wine wasn't chilled and things like that. So I fell into it. They thought, oh, she's got a gob, so we'll give her a job as a waitress. I was a terrible waitress, but I loved the whole shebang of it. And it was an opening. It was an American company, I think, which supported my personality and how they did learning and development and culture. They were not coming from a hierarchical system. They were coming from a very collaborative, everybody involved, everybody had an opinion. Like, we were very forward thinking in what they were doing in terms of communication. Like, now I'm still trying to put into place things that we were doing back in 1999. So it was a gem and a treat that changed my life. And I just got obsessed. I got obsessed. The first person I served was Leonardo DiCaprio, the very first, and I elbowed him in the stomach because I couldn't lift up the plates. You
know? I once dropped a butter knife on Tobey Maguire.
See, I elbowed you. They probably were on the same table. He was probably there.
It's almost as if we are celebrities.
No, I do have I will digress. Keep me on track. I do have a funny story. It was during the time when Westlife were massive, yes, and they were releasing an album. So this is when I was still a waitress, and so it used to be Club 170 was the VIP table, you know, the big table, and we were looking after Westlife. So it was their album launch, something about Around the World, and me and my friend Hannah, who's still my best friend, were the key waitresses to look after them. But during the event, there was paparazzi there, and they'd said, oh, we want to get photos of Westlife and pouring of the champagne, and we got really excited, and they moved me and my friend Hannah away and got prettier waitresses in.
Oh my god, the shade.
The shame that we were dissed. We weren't good enough for a Westlife, you know, evening standard shot. And so we stood at the side. holding the champagne where the prettier waitresses were held. And then we were asked to move back in.
You know, the press in this country, the more you know, the darker and darker the story becomes.
Awful. And it was when I realized that, okay, I really am about my personality and not my looks. That's why I was employed. Good. It was wonderful. It was glorious. And it changed my life. And that set me on the scene to opening restaurants.
When did you understand it as your career? Like, when did you release that idea of, like, I want to be in the arts, I'm going to be an actress, I'm going to, like, this is my path. And I love my job. And it's great. And I'm learning all this fabulous stuff. And now, oh, wait a second. I'm this is just what I do now.
I think I loved it so much, you know, because it was the glory days. Money was rolling in. Teams were very, very eclectic from all over. I think I was loving it so much. I think I sort of forgot that that was the other thing that I wanted to do. And I think in a way, a bit like it was a performance every night anyway. And it probably took me 10 years later that I realized the change had happened without me really acknowledging it. And somewhere deep in my belly, I think I realized very quickly, this was where I was supposed to be. This was the moment. This was going to be the journey. And that was okay. Because I loved it. And if you love something, you don't miss what you don't have.
What was the best job you had, and what was the worst job you had?
They've always been the best jobs. I love a challenge, and I like
all,
it.
All of them?
Yeah, well, because even when the clients are mad or assholes or wrong, I can't think of a time where, and I've worked for the same people for very long periods of time, so I'm very familiar with my madness, their madness. I think the jobs that when you can't do what you need to do, you know, where the expectation of what is wanted because of financial restraints or location restraints I was a consultant for years. So the alignment of what we needed to achieve, or I'll tell you what's complicated is when you work with hotels and it's political in hotels, different to standalone businesses, and everybody wants to just cover their backs. Yes. So you're brought in at times to be a consultant to go, they were wrong. You know, it's their fault. So I found that hard. Or if I just had some misogynistic older prick fundamentally, and I have to, I would confidently navigate that, but it was unnecessary. Like, thank God I was the way I was, that I am here for this navigation, though I shouldn't have had to. And I was young to be going through some of them. Their immaturities and me being mature more than not. And the best, there's too many to choose from, but they always have the running theme that there was an excitement, that there was a pressure, and that the team made it memorable. And so there would be too many best to have, though they always have the same thing. Shit, it's the fan. What are we going to do about it? And the whole team are in it together, like, buckle up and let's do this. And it becomes the ride of your life. And friendships were strongly made for them, for me, for the whole thing.
There's nothing sort of as intoxicating as that kind of trauma bonding.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you're just looking across the room and you're like,
yeah. You know what? And it's interesting because it's a point that I talk about nowadays, because we have so much more information now and we're so much more educated. Like, we were blind, naive previously. We didn't understand the impact we were having on people, or who could cope or who wasn't coping. We just didn't know. Though, I think there's a warning sign as well, as I talk about when we do work, of that we too quickly get to this conversation of that we're stressed. So I do it. There's three parts. There's stretched, there's stressed, and there's overwhelmed. Like, overwhelmed, out the door, we can't cope. The trauma's going to go raw. It's going to go deep. You know, we need out for a second, whether that's a moment, whether that's a week, whatever. Stressed is, I need help, and we can take the help on. And trauma is created. I do think there's an element of this stretched element, and we're not acknowledging it, where it's uncomfortable and it is hard, but it is fun. But our mindset is telling us that this isn't good for us. And actually, if we flip the mindset to, I'm not there, I don't need to ask for help, we're in this together, collectively, I can do this. And that's where we grow our resilience, and where the resilience is missed is we jump that step and we go fine to stressed. And there's something in between that we need to work on. But yes, back to your point, collective trauma.
I think that's really fascinating what you're saying. And it's such a beautiful skill when your ass is on the fire and you just can figure it out, especially when you're with other people who also have that. And I think, and you don't touch it that often once you leave service. And like, now that I'm not on the floor of a restaurant all the time, I get it. Like, I planned a bachelorette party recently. I mean, but in the process of executing this bachelorette party, I could feel that, because I was like, oh, do I ever have this fucking down, you know? Or are you like a family function, like a funeral, a shiva, whatever. And there's all these moving parts and you're just like, bah, 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 bah. And it's the capacity to do that, to like recuse quickly, to problem solve that way. It's like, I always said, I was like, the best waitresses I know would be phenomenal urgent care nurses. Like it's for real. Yes. Like,
and I think also for where we say in hospitality that we need to build people up, the more people can do openings, the better, because you learn them skills because you've got no other choice. Because everyone's like at the same stage as we are when we lack knowledge, we lack knowingness, we lack competence in the environment. So even if you have a room with openings of everyone can be a, everyone's a skilled bartender, everyone's a skilled, that opening night, it's like no one's done it before in their life because we don't know the environment. But what that does is we, this collectiveness and this collaboration and this working it out together has to happen because there's no other way. And I think that I was lucky that my job became doing openings. And so that became, and it's not for everyone, but I like the drive. I like the arse twitch. I like the uncertainty, you know, I like the, what are we going to do about it feeling? And it isn't for everyone.
Yeah, it really depends on the person. And I think the thing that I see here a lot, or in this country particularly, is because the wages tend to skew quite low in very expensive places to live, that the sheer amount of hours you have to do is crazy just to survive. And so the problem isn't, even people that are really, really gifted at that and have that resilience and love it, if they do it for 10 years, because they're doing it 70 hours a week, it's completely unsustainable. And I think the mistake people make is they look at the environment and they're like, oh, stress bad. And I'm like, this isn't bad. It's just that you need less of it in order to stay healthy. So it's in a model where you can do it 4 days a week, not six. All of a sudden you get all of the good parts of it and you don't end up in a place where you're completely burnt out and you have to do something else. And then you end up really understimulated because you're not honoring that part of you that loves all that action.
Yeah. And, you know, at the place that the multiple times I burned out, I hadn't created the space for the me. It was so much of the do. Like it would end up with me on holiday on my own because all my mates had been already booked it because I would never book anything because I didn't know when work was. I'm like Marta moment. And I'm, you know, I'm on holiday reading Arianna Huffington Thrive, trying to come up with all the answers. But I've slept for 72 hours because I'm absolutely dead, you know. And we didn't, honestly, that's me. Get a book to answer every question on my own in Sri Lanka because I got no friends at this. Not that I don't have friends. I've not planned anything. Mm-hmm. And your point, and we do this with people understanding time, and this is a relevant point with you. We have more time, though you have to work out where are you bleeding time, but that's the same with stress and energy. Where are you bleeding energy? And if we could plan more, like I believe in predictability over flexibility, and I can get them 2 days off together and not one on a Wednesday and a Sunday with a close into an opening, if I can create the space to fill my battery back up, I can cope then.
1,000%. I always, people are like, what is like the fastest thing I can do to like help change the mental health of my teams? And I'm like, do your rotas a month in advance.
Yeah. Though I was listening to, I went to a counter talk talk the other day, and Raj from Boobala was on it saying that the team was saying, you know, wonderful, charismatic, knowledgeable, kind, sweet, like everything. Like I want to be friends with him. We're not friends, but Raj, if you're listening.
I can hook you up. Yeah.
Let's go for lunch. But in terms of, he was saying that the teams were saying they didn't want it. But sometimes, like I do now, what people need and what people want are very different things.
100%. When I tried to bring this in at my last restaurant, they were all like, a month in advance, like, da, da, da. And I was like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do it for 3 months. If at the end of that 3 months, you're like, Rach, we fucking hate this. We love getting our schedule on a Friday for the next Monday. Then we'll go back to your way. We'll do it that way. And guess what? Like, nobody had that feedback.
And it's the thing with, we're all resistant to change as human beings. We don't like it, but we're fine with evolution. So you gave them the ability to experiment. And then I'm fine because I get an opinion on it and we can experiment. And then actually, most of the time, there's another fight to have. Though back to the thing you were saying about this month in advance, and where I said Asia de Cuba in St. Martin's Lane Hotel was forward thinking. Our rota was, everybody knew. So it was a rota. We had a consistent business, a very consistent business. So with a consistent business, we knew how many covers. We were going to be doing over 500 covers, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, which makes the money's rolling in, so everything's easy. So let's put that into context.
Yeah.
Though we had a rolling rota. Yes. So you knew everybody just rolled. So the rota stayed the same as the shifts that needed to be covered. Yes. And your name would just go to the top and you would move down and go to the top and you would move down. And if you knew you had something coming up and somebody else's shift pattern looked better than yours a week in advance, you would go to them, not the manager, to swap your week with them. Mm-hmm. So the manager just rolled the rota, never redid his rota every week, but he had consistency fine. But if you have consistency, you just roll the names, the shift structure stayed the same. The names just went up and down. And if people wanted to swap what was coming up with them, they went to the person who was coming in on that week. So we had predictability 6 months out. It wasn't even something we had to think about.
Exactly what you're saying is that it does two things. Where one, and I love that idea that you believe in predictability, not flexibility. 1,025%, like I could stand up and cheer if I was wearing trousers, but
do it anyway.
But it's that sense of like, what can we remove off the plate of the leadership? Because I think this is an industry where so often, because it's meritocratic and you end up with people that work hard and are great, and then you promote them really, really quickly, and nobody's built in with the skills of like, okay, what is managing a team actually like? And so you end up with people that are the nanny, the girlfriend, the therapist, the GP, the manager, the ops manager, you know, they're like, it's so huge. And so the more that labor that you can take off their plate and have the staff actually take on, not only does it give them ownership of the whole operation, but it's yep. also a situation where you now have a manager who can actually like do their job.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And have the space to think. What the problem is, we live in urgency the whole time. So we don't have the space to think what we need to do. I'm doing an experiment with a fast food UK brand where we're doing something called a shadow board. Yes, we try to get all the senior leaders in the room from GMs up to work out, you know, what are the issues, what do we need to do to move forward. The problem is their cognitive load is so full. They can't get to curiosity. They can't get to critical thinking. They can't get to ideas. They're just in survival mode. I haven't got the space, the emotional capacity to get to that. So then I went, okay, we need to help them. So let's get the part-timers, the younger generation, the Gen Zs, give them the problems and see what ideas they come up with. And then they are going to mentor and coach their GMs and ops. So they gain autonomy, they grow in their responsibility, and the managers then can help that way. And it's an experiment we're trying out. But your point is they're flooded. And when you're flooded, you can't move forward. You just hamster wheel, hamster wheel, hamster wheel.
That is fucking smart, Michelle.
You know what? It's not obviously not my idea. Everything's stolen. Though I don't know. I don't know where I heard it or read it on a beach on my own in Sri Lanka. Them days are gone, but you know what I mean? It wasn't Arianna Huffington on this occasion, though highly recommend that book back to. I don't know where I read it, but there's not much information on it. So I probably could steal it and put myself all over it. We're in it together.
100%. Like, you just let me know what you'd like me to keep in and keep out of the last few minutes. Can you speak a little bit to the folks that may have been dotted around your professional life that helped inform your idea of what the industry can be, where you were like, that's fucking great the way that they do it, or there's someplace I can go? Because obviously when you started a waitress at a hotel, you're not like, wow, one day I'll travel the world and open restaurants. You know, like, the path isn't always clear.
Though I think I'm a risk taker. So if somebody, and I'm curious and I want to be upfront. So I think people gave me an opportunity and I jumped on board. So to your question, the first person, my first GM, Mike Hayden, who is at the Hippodrome now, who is an absolute wonderful man, again, was very forward thinking without us knowing, was all about the people. And when I got my first promotion to assistant manager, and we didn't collaborative ways, we didn't have a structure like head waitress. I was just one of the ones who was bossy. And when I got my first promotion, he said to me, Michelle, you're going to start on New Year's Eve, and what I want you to do for the next 3 months is shut up. And he said, I just want you to pay attention, listen. He went, everything that you normally do, helping people or directing people, whichever way it was, I don't want you to do anything. And let's get everybody used to you. And then in 3 months' time, he went, any bad cop stuff, I'm on it. You just go in as the supporter, the cheerleader. And it was the greatest thing that he gave me, because it got everybody. I didn't have the most uncomfortable step up is middle management anyway. You've got so much to learn. But to do that step up in it with your colleagues and your friends is so hard for everybody. I want to be my friends. I don't want to be their friends. I'm supposed to be authoritarian. My ego gets in the way. I'm supposed to be the, like, it's a really, really challenging part of your journey. But him just giving me that tool meant I had a much gentler process into it. So he gets a massive hands up, and that was him all over. So he taught me how to be. And the other thing he sort of taught me was, before you ever go and give somebody, before we had Kim Scott and Radical Candor and all of that, he said, before you ever go and give people feedback, you remember what makes them brilliant. And he went, and you never go into that conversation until you think about what makes them brilliant. And he went, and then you'll go in with a kinder mindset. Yeah, so he gets a massive shout out. He inspired us. He made it exciting, and he made us not stress about things. He was like, we'll all be fine.
It's just dinner.
Yeah. Well, that's what he said. Nobody's dead. We're just serving food. That would be his sentence. Nobody's dead. We're just serving food.
Absolutely. And our worst day at work, like, no one's dying. Well, yeah. Allergens, but you know, for the most part, I would say.
We didn't have them in 99.
Yeah. What a time.
We didn't know that. I can remember an Australian person, Kate, I remember clearly, she was our cashier, and she went, I'm lactose intolerant. And it was like she was speaking Japanese to me, and I was like, you what? She went, lactose intolerant. I went, we don't have that in London. We don't have that. We didn't have allergies. It just didn't exist.
Being in the industry, as a woman particularly, especially as you were moving in and you were doing openings and you're traveling, and so you're in different cultures, different teams, it has its own challenges, I think, particularly in leadership positions. What are sort of the main things that you came across that were gender specific, and what were sort of the takeaways that you had from those experiences?
I look back now and realize she, like I talk about myself as in my younger self as Michelle, she had to navigate very, very challenging situations that were naively supported by this is just how it is. And I'll give you some examples. One question, would I do that now sort of thing? And I definitely wouldn't give the advice. Like, I was in a situation where owner had done some like sexual advances towards me, not where I felt scared or intimidated, but we're in a lift after a thing and come back to my hotel room. No. And then I got accused publicly of literally fucking the GM, which I wasn't. I was having sex with somebody else, by the way. And going to somebody for help and that being, I'll sort it, but I'll sort it off the record. And so what happened was then we just didn't talk, but they weren't dealt with. Like, it was unacceptable. I was 27, 28. This person's in their 40s. And I had to learn how to hold my own professionally when I was in the situation that was unacceptable. And I'm proud of her, how she handled it. But I don't think she needed to be put in that pressure of it. And I don't know whether it would happen nowadays. And if it does, I hope people understand that you only get to excuse this shit. This behavior need dealing with. I think even they would have thought, well, it's just fine. You know, well, it's not just fine. There's nothing fine about it. I shouldn't feel intimidated and uncomfortable by your advances. The other one, though, is I also understood how thick men could be very, very quickly. So I would play the character you wanted me to be. If I looked like your granddaughter, then it would be, I would play the granddaughter, you know, I would come in sweet, innocent, giggly, I flutter in. If I knew the only thing you cared about was your penis, I went in with the tightest dress possible and I worked it and owned it. I don't think I would offer that advice now, but did it work for me? Yeah. Do I think being a woman changes who you are in leadership? Yeah, but you get the benefits of it as well. You get to be the nurturer, you get to be the look after, you get to all the soft skills, they say, that makes great leaders. You get to explore, you're given the opportunity to develop people and be there for them. So I think like anything in life, there's pros and cons to it, and we've still got a lot to learn. And I think for women coming through in this generation, there's a huge worry with this idea of like imposter syndrome. Now, I fully agree with the concept of imposter syndrome. My issue with it, especially for women, is that you should feel uncertain. You should feel unsure. It's really bloody good for you. Like if you're feeling like an imposter, bloody great. Good. That's exactly where you should be. It's not an identity. It's a process in life. And the danger is, how is it talked about? And that's my concern for women, is that we'll end up limiting ourselves with this identity we're given. And no, it's a really bloody great process that we should be going through and should be supported.
Because there's so much code switching. I mean, that's exactly what you're describing, right? It's like you're going to read the vibe of a certain person, and then you're going to show up in the way that they need you to pacify them, to get the stuff you need to get done. I think we do that, and we've been taught to do that from a super young age as young women. Yeah. And I wonder how much that contributes to imposter syndrome, because if I know that if I was being super genuine with the person I'm having a meeting with, I'd be bringing a different energy. I'm reading the room and I'm bringing what needs to be brought to pacify you, to keep myself safe. I think that happens. To also like have fun, quite frankly, to make a connection, all of that stuff. But then it's hard to know, is my skill, are the fundamental things that I'm bringing, where does that sort of play acting end and my true like value or skill begin? And I think that's one of the reasons why for women particularly, and particularly young women, that's why it's so heightened, is because it's like when you're wearing the mask constantly, when do you trust which parts are you? Or it's very easy to lose sight of that. And I think it's what makes you good in this business. So I think about that all the time, because like the way I'm going to talk to my chef. So like I'm talking to the customer and they're like, my egg is too hard and I'm pregnant or whatever. And I'm like, oh my God, no bother. Like, let me just take that back. We're going to throw you out. No. And I go down to the chef and I need him to make me a new egg. And I know he's going to be an asshole about it. So I'm going to be like, there's this bitch upstairs who is moaning to me about the egg. And I'm going to get that thing done. And that chef isn't going to have like some kind of ego collapse in the middle of service. And the customer is going to feel taken care of and cared about and listened to and important and powerful and all the things that they're trying to achieve from giving me shit about their egg. So it's that very thing that makes you so brilliant at the job that becomes the way that you function professionally. And it's so hard to undo that. Also, like,
we enjoy it.
There's like a something fun about the role play of like helpful waitress, you know?
Exactly. And the way you say it though is so interesting, because I think that was probably what I was just very good at. Like whether I was younger, whether I was a different culture, whether especially because we did consulting in so many different countries, like, you know, going to the Middle East, I was only early 30s when I was, you know, I had a pretty director level going into the Middle East. That learning, see, it's never felt uncomfortable there. It's just learning the politeness. But I think I was very good at it, though. I think I'm very aware of who I am. And layered with that, at the same time, you're fully getting me. Somebody in my early days of training said to me that you should always be your own song. Yeah, so say, let's pick, we'll be Beyonce of Crazy in Love. You'd always be that song. We do this in initial trainings years ago when I was opening restaurants. So you pick your song, that's your personality, that's who you are. Though, the volume level of that song and the environment would change. So if you've just got up in the morning, it's come on the radio, you've got one vibe. If it's Ibiza 3 o'clock in the morning on the seventh day of your holiday, you've got another vibe. It's still the same song. And I think I had the ability to change the volume very, very quickly, but my song never changed. You got me.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because there is something to it that it's not that it's fake. And I think this is what people don't understand. It's like, oh, that person's full of shit, or that person completely changes their personality. No. It's all genuine. And like the part of me that's telling the chef, like, this fucking lady with her egg, that's real. I am like, fuck off with your egg. I'm busy. Yeah. The part of me that goes to her and is like, here's your new egg. I hope you really enjoy it. That's also true. I hope she has a great time. And I am like, I want her to get what she wants. So it's like, I think there's an idea that all those versions of ourselves that we use or engage with, that there's something, that they're dishonest, but maybe that's sexism, the reason that we perceive it that way.
I think it's more to do with, if you're like in this, you know, culture, like power is wherever the money is, you know, wherever the money is where the power is. And that changes culture to culture. So let's say we're in Europe, you know, and a white middle-class male, they're not thinking, they don't have to play a game. It's the road's really easy for them. They're not sweating it out. So they don't have to have this agility. So they would be a part of any minority that the agility has to come, you know, because I have to be aware of who I am in this situation, whether that's because of your sexuality, because of the color of your skin, because of your religion, because of your gender, whatever it is, I have to be aware. They don't have to be aware. They're just, you know, walking down the street, like, you know, having a nice time. They don't have to be aware. So will that be part of it? Yes. That's the hill we climb.
How did sort of all of this feed into what you're doing now and you getting started with QAB leadership? And how did that transition sort of happen?
I got forced into it. I had worked for a company for 16 years and we got bought out by a Saudi company. And I stopped getting invited to meetings. And so it got to the point that I was so humiliated, and I love being in a leader. Like, I want to be in the room of decision making. I don't want to be literally making the notes and building the presentations. So out of devastation, which it was, which coincided, my last day was the day we were all told by Boris to stay indoors, I got given this gift of COVID, and I had just been on a plane for 15 years. Which country am I in? Where am I going? What's going on? And I wouldn't, we just have to stop. It worked. And then I met somebody who has his primary carer of his child. And I'd been given, like, 18 months before COVID happened, this partner and a child. I'd never wanted a child myself biologically. And all of a sudden I've got this. And so COVID became a, like everything in life, life's complex, a mourning of who Michelle Moreno was. An excitement of this, God, this is what life looks like when you stop, you know, and it was wonderful, and experiencing them, and a gift I never knew I was going to get in a partner and a child. That is the greatest blessing I ever have received thus far in life, and an opportunity to go, okay, what do you want to do next? So I was lucky enough that I am good with money. Like, I made a shitload and I am good with money. Like, my dad taught me bank it. So I was in the luxury situation of, I'm financially got stability in terms of I don't need to make a rush decision. And I decided to choose the purpose route. What's happening at the moment? Hospitality is fucked. Yeah, we don't know, you know, because of Brexit, because of COVID, because P&Ls have like trained us to, we've cost controlled the living shit out of our business. We don't know how to reimagine what does business, financially, people, hospitality look like for the future, for it to be successful. And I thought, I want to be part of that conversation. I want to be part of that conversation. Now, what am I great at? I am great at problem solving. I am great at a challenge. Buckle up, bring it on. And I know how to unleash people's potential and bring people together to move it forward. And so I just started exploring what might it look like on my own of how I can help the industry. And it's evolving. Like, it looked like I'm doing leadership workshops. I realize I can do more. I'm now working with founders, doing a lot more strategy stuff, but bringing the teams with us to come up with all the collaboration and creativity, and really making people understand that you've got to learn to embrace the uncertainty and learn to ride the urgency. And so that is where, and it is evolving regularly. It's an ongoing, like, it's like, I suppose, how people write books, you know. I'm trying to work out where I can help. I want to help the industry and I want to help myself as well. I'm not deluded. Like, you know, I like the Michelle Moreno show. I like it. I enjoy it. The performance element, I like it, you know. And I want to bloody help this industry individually, collectively, as teams, as businesses. I want to grow our resilience so we can understand and open our mind up to what can successful business look like in our industry moving forward. And I want to be part of that. I want to be at the front of that conversation. So this is where I am. Through I was through trauma, this was created. And that's the truth. It was mourning. I had to mourn who I was, what my identity was, and have to recreate and recreating still what that future will look like. And it's scary.
What was like the wackiest thing you did when you were finally confronted with stillness?
Oh, I don't know. I've always been wacky. So I think wacky is normal. Like I've always been a It slowed down in terms of I didn't have responsibility for others. So I'm now, I don't have stress. I don't have to respond to a P&L. I don't have Saturday, Sunday morning, holidays, emailing all the time. So all of that stopped. But then that just meant I have a lot of energy. We're not sitting down, you know, apart from any episodes of Housewives, Atlanta, you know, I'm there for to shit television.
I could talk to you about Housewives for the next 3 hours.
Which is your favorite? I have a few favorites.
Okay, New York is my all-time favorite. Like, I'm rewatching it with a friend of mine who's never seen it. We were just introduced to Kelly Ben Simone jogging in the street. Like, I'm fucking obsessed with those women.
I watch Bethany Frankel. I watch, it's like the first thing I watch on Instagram and YouTube. I've even started watching her on YouTube. She's such a mad bitch, but I love her.
Amen, me too. I also can't believe, so I wanted to listen to her podcast about divorce, but she pulled the episodes.
Because her mum passed away. See, I'm here.
I know. You get it. Bowsy.
I get it.
That's, isn't that, you know, there's a Housewives fan lurking in the most unexpected places.
Yeah, this is, we've already bonded more. Though, I interrupted you. New York, fine. What's your second one?
It's hard to say. I'm crazy about Potomac. I also... Okay, everyone says that. Did you only watch the first season?
I'm not, I wouldn't know. I'm not familiar.
Okay, Somebody that I really trust was like, just give it a crack and get to season three. Just trust me, give it a crack and get to season three. I did that and oh my God, it is good. It's a sleeper hit. And then I just watched all of OC for the first time.
You know, like how not to be as a human being. I was like, what are you watching? I went, you just can't believe this. You just cannot, everything about it.
Heather Dubrow, I fucking love that woman. I love her. That's the Jewish representation I want to see in the world. I also was trying to explain it to my, so my partner thinks this shit is trash, like hates it. And I tried to explain to her, I was like, the way that you think about the football and the football players, and like we'll be on the tube and she's like, this guy goes here and this one da da da, and like we watch loads of the women, so then it's like this one's dating this one because they're all gay, and it's like this whole thing, and I was like, when I talk to you about Housewives, that's what we're doing. And as a result of that conversation, I got to spend a whole Uber ride to Crouch End discussing Potomac, and it was the joyous day. But it's probably good she hates it, because otherwise I'd literally never leave my house. What is your favorite?
Because they just, you know, like it's just Heather Dubrow. She has that life that you just think, when does she eat? Like she just drinks champagne, though. No? I don't think she eats. She just gets a calorie intake from
the
champagne.
Thing about Heather is that, like, if she was living in just like a totally normal house, dropping her kids at the JCC, she would be exactly the same. Like, there isn't, like, yeah, she's like outrageous and she's a little out of touch because she's so rich and she's got a personal chef, whatever. But like the nachas, like the essentialness of her is still there in a way that like Vicky, fucking delusional. Who even knows where that woman lives? Do you know? So it's like, that's what I like about Heather, is like her circumstances are crazy, but she's like.
The thing with Vicky is she's a survivor in terms of, it just blows my mind that you lie about cancer and it's fine, you're back on the telly. Like, is nobody watching what is going, but then I'm still watching, you know.
She's being nailed to the cross like Jesus Christ.
Honestly, that's what I call it. Like I do that about my mother hanging off like a martyr. Shannon just blows my mind. Like I keep up to date on YouTube of what's going on with all of that situation.
This next season, Tamara will give up on taking down Heather, obviously. Like it's unsustainable. You can't shake her. She's the queen. And now we've got Shannon with the DUI. And because I've just watched all of it pretty quickly, I know that when Gina got her DUI, Shannon was like, what an irresponsible devil trash woman. And I'm like, okay, Shannon, What now? And her poor dog.
Well, all right then. So we're going to do it. And I do like Atlanta. I like Atlanta.
Yeah, I've never watched Atlanta.
Oh, it's good. Atlanta, they're balmy as well, Atlanta. But you've got to watch it from the beginning because there's so many long-term. Yeah.
You know that thing where they're like, oh, start on season three, start on season seven. I'm a purist. I'm like, you've got to suffer through every single episode.
Well, because you've got to understand their history because it's so like a roller coaster. You've got to understand it. Otherwise, it always, well, it's crazy anyway. Anyway, well, good. I'm glad. I'll come over. I'll do Atlanta again from the beginning.
Like, I don't drink anymore. And I genuinely believe that I've replaced alcohol with Housewives. It's all addiction. It's just now it's like a different thing. 100%. Okay. If you could, just to like bring it back a little, although I'm going to keep all of that in because I'm obsessed.
Yeah, of course.
If you could make one universal change that magically became implemented into every hospitality business, what would it be?
I'd get rid of the P&L and I'd reimagine what the lady, I can't remember her name, Anrad something. She used to be one of the big people in Apple. And she went on to run, I think, Save the Children for America. And she said you change a P&L report to a people and impact report. And I think if we were measuring different things and we weren't wasting our time on rebuilding budgets that are never obtainable, and then everybody spends their life being a disappointment and the pressure of trying to achieve a budget that isn't achievable because we have to sign the budget off for us, but it's not going to work. If we could get rid of that, we could then have the energy, the creativity, the curiosity to look at what else is working and not waste our time on forecasting and paperwork and bureaucracy and not reality, you know. Mm-hmm. And also the problem is all the decisions we've made is why, like I did a post the other day about stop romanticizing the past. It wasn't working. Why we had an exodus of people wanting to work for it, why we have substance abuse, why we have mental health issues, why we had so much burnout and we still have it, but why we weren't even aware about it. It's because we weren't running it healthily. So it's dry. But these types that they're still using, was I talking about it today? Oh, I was. Ostrich isn't another LinkedIn post. I write daily on LinkedIn and it comes from Brené Brown. Are you a scrambler or an ostrich as a leader? And ostriches, when they bury their head in their sand and they're using the same old systems to work on modern day problems, and that's I'm going to cost cut. It doesn't work. That's why you've got no staff in the first place. We haven't reimagined what the business model looks like for success. So in fear, we're people, it's our brand, it's all about people, but now I'm going to go and do this because I have to survive. That would be the change I'd make.
Mm-hmm. Quick fire questions. Mm-hmm. Where is your favorite place to travel food wise?
Lebanon.
Who is your favorite pop icon?
Barbra Streisand. Is she pop?
For me, yeah. What is the best meal that you've had in the past month?
Oh, I went to, I got, one of my clients is MJMK and they invited me to call for my birthday. Smashed it.
Yeah. So good. Favorite building in London?
My home. I live at the top of Brixton Hill and we have a massive, it's a huge, I suppose, Georgian house with like five, and my flat's apartment is right at the top, and the view down the street is from COVID through friends having nervous breakdowns, whatever it is, that window, that archway window is safety, so nothing beats it.
Who is your hospitality hero? It can be someone you've never met, it can be someone you've worked with, just somebody in the industry who you look at and you're like, literally amazing.
If she listens to this, she'll kill me and cry at the same time. One of my best friends is Annie Wilde. Her last role in London was F&B director at The Standard. And her journey was through we met in Mykonos in 2003. She walked in for a trial shift. I was going on for a wedding. I said, be back here in 3 days. And 20 years later, we're still best friends. And she is probably one of the unsung heroes. She would never won an award. She's never going to put herself forward. But she has grafted and put people first and put hospitality first her whole career. And she is one of them women that everybody who knows her loves her. Like, to the point that you go, fucking Anna, because she's so gorgeous. But she is beautiful in every sense. And everything about her life is hospitality. And she never get shouted about, but she would be my hospitality hero.
Michelle, you have just been maybe my favorite guest, and it's probably because we talked about Bravo, but also thank you so much for the work you're doing and for sharing your wisdom with us. I've had the best time.
Thank you.
Beyond the Pass is produced by Kelly's Cause. For more information about Kelly's Cause, please head to kellyscause.com or find us on Instagram at kellyscause.